Hello, my friends. It's Monday, May 19th, 2025, and I'm your host, Radical Russ Belville, your Red State refugee. And welcome to the Radical Russ Show, coming to you from Rolla J Studios in my undisclosed mountain hideaway in the beautiful state of Jefferson region of Southern Oregon. On this week's program, Joe Biden's cancer diagnosis reignites speculation about his health during his term in office. Trump's Qatari bribe plane finally makes Schumer take action. A brain-dead Georgia woman is forced into birth slavery. School boards all over America, including mine, are MAGA-infested. How the housing crisis is affecting Oregon and California. Two more reasons to boycott Idaho and avoid the handmaid state. And a radical rant on anti-Semitism versus transphobia. But before we get to all that serious stuff, I've got to break the great news here at Rolla J Studios that we have puppies! That's right, we've got puppies! Chihuahua puppies. Five Chihuahua puppies born on May 16th. Actually, four of them born on May 16th and one born at 1 in the morning on May 17th. It was a long night here at Rolla J Studios watching my beautiful little Chihuahua puppies being born from their mom, Susie Q, and their daddy, little Kenny. Little Kenny Chihuahua's here as well. So they're just adorable. You can see pictures up on my feed at RadicalRust.com on Blue Sky, and I'll have a post up at RadicalRust.com as soon as I get to it. And they'll be ready for adoption sometime around 4th of July, we suppose, maybe a little later. So if you're interested in a healthy, beautiful Chihuahua puppy, please let me know. Also, I made some changes this weekend to the RadicalRust.com website. Finally got a chance to sit down and fix some glitches, and it's working better than ever. I encourage you all to check it out. It also includes some of my random rants from the past, and folks, my rants go all the way back to August of 2003. Now, I haven't been able to find all of them online, but most of my rants I've been able to find both in print and online, and I've put them at RadicalRust.com. And as I was surfing through some of the random rants, one came up from 20 years ago. It was June 1st, 2005, and it was lamenting how I was just about to head to my 20th year class reunion, and I was all upset because I was 6 foot, 280 pounds. Oh my God, I totally forgot that I actually weighed 280 pounds at one point. I remembered 260. I had forgotten 280. So yeah, I was 280 for my 20-year class reunion. Then I got down to 240 for my 30-year class reunion. As we're hitting my 40th year class reunion this next month, I should be down to 200. Folks, at this rate, by my 50th class reunion, I'll only weigh 160 pounds, and by my 70th reunion, I'll be dead. I'll have wasted away. So no more Radical Russ. Also, other things I wanted to get to real quick. I'm out shopping, as I do, because I'm a hobbyist podcaster, so I do the shopping apps and the gig apps to keep food on the table, and I'm out there shopping. And I found this, the Oreo section, and something about America, man, we've got a product for everyone. There's Oreo, there's regular Oreos, right? And then you got your double stuff Oreos that got twice as much of the white stuff, double stuff. And then they have the mega stuff Oreos that's like triple the stuffing, although mega, it should be a million times, right? Regardless, I saw one the other day that was like the most stuff. It was called Oreo, the most stuff. And the package declared that it's the most stuff you'll ever have between two Oreo cookies. I don't want to limit our American capitalism. I think if they want to come up with an Oreo that comes in a Pringles can, where there's one cookie on the bottom, one cookie on the top, and everything in between is stuff, and call it, I don't know, Giga stuff, Terra stuff, let them do it. More Oreos for everyone. And speaking of a product for everyone, the other product that caught my eye the other day, because, you know, I have to be shopping for everyone, and I end up shopping sometimes for feminine products that, of course, I would never have purchased. And so the person I was shopping for had me shopping for them to get some Monistat 3. for the vaginal yeast infection, you know, the Monistat, right? And so I go and find the thing, and I'm thinking, Monistat 3, didn't it used to be Monistat 7? Huh, okay, so I get to the aisle, and there on the aisle there is not just Monistat 7 for 7-day relief, and Monistat 3 for 3-day relief, but there's also a Monistat 1 for 1-day relief. So, ladies, no matter how long you'd like to keep your yeast infection going, they've got a product for you. I don't know about me. If it was me, I would think that 1 day was like the end goal of this product. You'd have figured, like, by the time they came out with Monistat 1, they wouldn't need any Monistat 3 or Monistat 7. But I don't know. Maybe some of you out there are like, you know, curing my yeast infection in 1 day, that's just way too quick. I don't know how it works, but there you go. And speaking of that kind of stuff, I have one other pledge for you. You know, I go out shopping a lot, and I'm going to all these public bathrooms, you know, in like a Starbucks or a grocery store or McDonald's or whatever. And it's bad enough that they've got, you know, because of people misusing the restroom facilities, they've got the locks on the doors now. You got to put in some code, and you got to go, you know, walk up to some clerk or, you know, barista and say, excuse me, can I get your bathroom code? Like you're a little kid, right? But anyway, that's bad enough, right? But then you get into the bathroom, you use the facilities, and they got those goddamn motion sensor things to turn on the sink, you know, or to turn on the, to get the towels to come out, you know, and then the wave your hand in front of the dryer. So here you are, waving your hands around like you're, you know, Doctor Strange trying to cast some goddamn spell just to get some freaking water and towels to wash your goddamn hands. Folks, you elect me president, and I swear on day one, my first executive order will be to force every bathroom in America to go back to handles on the sinks and levers on the towel dispensers. Make America wash their hands again. By now, I'm sure you've all heard the terrible news that former President Joe Biden has been diagnosed with an aggressive form of late-stage prostate cancer that has metastasized to his bones, which is never a good sign. And we wish Joe and Jill all the best and hopes for a great recovery for him. But this has opened up a lot of questions about President Biden's one term in office, and the right wing have been making a lot of noise lately, aided by Jake Tapper from CNN and his latest book about the situation, about Joe Biden being too old and senile during his first term, and supposedly a cover-up happening to keep that concealed from the American people. And this does not help the fight for Joe Biden's legacy at all. Many people were very concerned about President Biden seeming to be senile, seeming to have lost a step, maybe not being all there cognitively. And there's been a lot of speculation that the folks in the White House were keeping this covered up or keeping it hidden from the American public. And when that debate happened, of course, they could no longer cover it up. It became obvious to the American people that Joe had lost a step, that he had become a little bit behind the times. And what's frustrating about this, you know, is that, of course, his late decision to leave the race left Kamala Harris with only 100 days or so to ramp up a campaign. She wasn't super well known among the population. And there's the question about not having a Democratic primary to properly vet all of the candidates. And sure enough, we ended up with Kamala Harris, which the way it all broke down, as late as it broke down after the debate and after the primaries had concluded, there really wasn't many other options than to have Kamala Harris move into the role. Had we stepped past the first black woman vice president and picked a white guy, let's say, to take Joe's place, we would have completely lost the base. We would have lost the black base even more so than we lost it in the election. It's unfair to expect Kamala Harris to be able to ramp up a campaign in 100 days, but even as she did so, the decision to hug a Cheney cost black votes as well. I was having a discussion online about this very subject with a black activist. I don't know if he's an activist, but a black observer of politics, who pointed out that the hug a Cheney move cost votes among black men because, as Democrats go, Joe Biden was the worst Democrat when it comes to the new Jim Crow. As Dr. Michelle Alexander put it in her groundbreaking book, The War on Drugs is the new Jim Crow. The war on drugs is the way that we keep black men down in this country. And so Joe Biden was the architect of the drug war. Joe Biden is the man who created the drug czar's office. Like, the drug czar would not exist. The Office of National Drug Control Policy would not exist without Joe Biden authoring that bill. He was also an author of the crime bill, the Clinton crime bill, that put 100,000 new cops on the streets and led to the era of mass incarceration that we're still reeling from. Joe Biden was the guy behind the bankruptcy bill, who makes it so that you can't discharge your student loan debt in bankruptcy proceedings. So all those student loan debtors out there, you have Joe Biden to thank for that as well. Mandatory minimum sentencing. All the worst aspects of the drug war you can think of, Joe Biden was behind all of them. I joked many times as Joe Biden was running for president that if President Biden just reversed everything Senator Biden ever stood for, he'd be up on Mount Rushmore. He'd be the greatest president ever. So when Joe Biden drops out of the race and Kamala Harris picks Liz Cheney as someone to be palling around with, black folks remember Dick Cheney's role in that drug war too, and lying us into the war in Iraq. So, Joe Biden's cancer diagnosis coming out brings all these questions back into the fore, and people are speculating on this, that the type of cancer he's got, prostate cancer, first of all, is the most easily detectable cancer. It's the one they can detect the quickest, and when they detect it early, there's a very high survival rate for it. It's very treatable. So for this cancer to go for so long, when the President of the United States has an annual physical, and for it to have metastasized all the way to the bone, this is something that should have been known a year ago, or 2 years ago, or maybe even 3 years ago. I've not heard of rapid onset prostate cancer that could happen in less than 4 months. So how much was being covered up in the Biden White House regarding his health? This is not helping any of that speculation. And further frustrating me here is the feeling that Joe Biden, when he ran for office in 2020, remember when he ran, he was the candidate that all of the centrist Democrats coalesced around. Even some that aren't so centrist, like Elizabeth Warren, Pete Buttigieg, Kamala Harris, all of them, they all coalesced around Joe Biden because Bernie Sanders ran away with the Iowa primary. And Bernie Sanders ran away with the New Hampshire primary. And that's when Clyburn, out of South Carolina, third in line in the octogenarian Democratic leadership, marshaled all the forces to coalesce behind Joe Biden, the guy that he believed could win, the guy that could derail the socialist candidacy of Bernie Sanders, what we really needed in this country after Donald Trump. So everybody coalesced around Joe Biden, who kept saying he would be a transitional president, that he would be a bridge to the future. Now, he never came out and explicitly made a one-term pledge. He never explicitly said, I will only serve for one term and then pass the torch. But everything that was framed around his running gave that impression. The impression that he would be a one-term president, that he would be there to be the serious, sober, sane elected official to clean up after the nightmare of Donald Trump and the January 6th insurrection, that we'd lock them up, and that he would be grooming a successor, perhaps Kamala Harris as VP, to turn the reins over to the younger generation to install a new generation of leadership. And folks, when Biden was running in 2020, I really believe a lot of people had that in mind. In fact, I'm going to go back to March of 2021, an article that was in The Hill that said, quote, Joe Biden campaigned on being a transition president during a pivotal time in the nation's history, saying he'd take the reins away from former President Trump and return the country to normal. But now, more than ever, those around him say he'll make another bid for the presidency. Quote, I don't think there's any reason to say that he won't, end quote, said one longtime advisor to the president. Another Biden ally added that Biden hasn't told associates that he wouldn't be running again, quote, so we all assume that he is, the ally said, contrary to the sentiment that he'll be a one-term president because of his own volition, end quote. So, as soon as March of 2021, 1 year into his term, he was already talking about running for another term. But people who voted for them had the feeling he was going to be a one-term president. He was already beleaguered by questions about his age then when he was running. He's too old to run then. And let me get you this other piece of text. Pick this one out of thebulwark.com, written by Steve Shale, who writes, quote, I believe he should have taken a one-term pledge. I felt this way in 2016 and again in 2020. I believe had he offered a one-term pledge in 2020, he would have won by a larger margin that year. We often gloss over how much his age was a real issue in 2020. It just wasn't as big of an issue as Trump. I also believe Biden should have announced in the middle of his term that he wasn't going to run again, and I often wonder what would have happened had the 2022 elections turned out differently. If he had, and done this in a way that talked about the realities of aging in the modern presidency, I don't think we'd be having the conversation about his frailties that is happening today. I believe the majority of Americans would have understood and even praised him for his honesty. Yes, absolutely. But there was something about it. You know, Joe Biden had been running for president since the 80s. I think he ran two or three times before and never made it. So he finally gets to the presidency, and that old white man ego just kicked in. He's passing the CHIPS bill. He's passing the bipartisan infrastructure law. He's failing to put his name all over that so people will understand that Democrats are the ones who are helping them. Regardless, he was a fantastic president. He did some amazing stuff, the Afghanistan withdrawal notwithstanding, even though that needed to happen and it was something that was scheduled by Trump. But as presidents go, one of the better presidents of my lifetime, at least legislatively speaking. But he couldn't get out of his own way. He couldn't subsume his own ego. He thought it was going so well, he should have another term. We don't want to stop the progress we're making now. Let's have another term. And in doing so, doomed this country to another 4 years of Trump. Now let's take some time to catch up on what's happening with the Trump maladministration. Of course, this last weekend, Trump made his first visits overseas, not to any of our steadfast allies or formerly steadfast allies in Europe or Canada or Australia or anything like that. No, he flew off to the petrostates, Saudi Arabia, UAE, and Qatar. Got to get the money, got to rake in the bling for Donald Trump and the these oil states currying favor with him, and they've all understood now that this is not the regular American presidency where you have to pretend to be making moves to address human rights abuses or anything serious like that. No, Donald Trump is one of them. Donald Trump operates in the same sphere they do. It's all about the Benjamins, baby. Who can you bribe? Who's got the money? So all of these Gulf states lining up to feat Donald Trump, to offer him all sorts of bribes, and none stands out any greater than the Qatari $400 million plane, the Flying Palace, which, by the way, folks, this is a used plane. The used plane that Qatar has been trying to unload for greater part of a decade now. Nobody else has been wanting to buy it. So they're just going to give it away to the president here as a bribe and be able to take that loss and actually gain something from it. And of course, a plane like that, getting from the Qataris, you never know what's going to be on it as far as, you know, listening devices, or hell, they could have a red button to blow the damn thing up for all we know. It, of course, will have to be hardened, armored, secured, encrypted in all sorts of ways. It's going to take even more millions of dollars to retrofit this damn plane when a new Air Force One is already on its way in 2 years. So there's already a scheduled replacement for the 40-year-old Air Force One plane. But that's not quick enough for Trump. He's got to get his $400 million flying palace, which, of course, he says isn't a bribe. He says not a bribe. It's a gift. Well, they could give us a gift. I'd be stupid to refuse a gift. Well, it's a blatant violation of the Emoluments Clause, which forbids the president from receiving any gifts from a foreign head of state unless approved by the United States Congress. The righties, of course, are out there. Carolyn Liar Leavitt out there trying to make excuses for it. It's not a gift to the president. It's just a gift. It's a gift to the U.S. Air Force to be used as Air Force One, which only Donald Trump can fly on. And then after he's not president, no other president can fly on it because it's going to be given to the Donald Trump Presidential Library, but it's not a gift to Donald Trump. It's just a gift to the Air Force and then a library that only Donald Trump can access. But it's not a gift for Donald Trump. It doesn't matter. This is obviously a violation of the Emoluments Clause. And the smartasses over on Fox and online keep trying to come back with, well, what about the gift of the Statue of Liberty? France gave us the Statue of Liberty. That was a gift. Yeah, did Grover Cleveland fly around in the Statue of Liberty? Was Grover Cleveland the only person ever allowed to go inside the Statue of Liberty? After Grover Cleveland left office, did they move the Statue of Liberty off of Ellis Island and put it in the Grover Cleveland Presidential Library? I don't think so. So you can miss me with the Statue of Liberty bullshit. And Congress approved that gift. It would have been a violation of emoluments had Congress not approved the gift. So go ahead, put this $400 Qatari bribe plane in front of Congress. Let's have a vote on it. Let's see which people want to put their name on the line saying, yes, I approve of the $400 bribe plane to the United States president from the Arab Gulf states. And one other reaction to this. So Chuck Schumer, the minority leader of the Senate, the leader of the Democrats in the Senate, couldn't be bothered to continue a filibuster against the continuing resolution that empowered DOGE, gave them a blank check to go about their merry ways. Couldn't be bothered. Got the disappearances of Abrego Garcia and Andre Hernandez and Ramesa Ozturk. We've got ICE just kidnapping people off the streets with no due process. And those of us who are pissed about this have been screaming for the Senate, for the House, for the Democrats to do something. And we understand there's not a lot they can do. They're in the minority. But there are two things they can do in the Senate. They can have a filibuster, which, again, Chuck gave up on, and they can put holds on nominations. You can grind the Senate business to a halt. One senator can put a hold on any nomination, and it's stuck. We could also be denying unanimous consent to move forward with anything. Up until now, Chuck hasn't moved on any of those things. Chuck hasn't done the holds thing. Chuck hasn't done the denial of unanimous consent thing, because apparently nothing that Trump has done so far has generated enough alarm bells for Chuck Schumer to get off his ass and start mucking up and grinding to a halt the gears of the Senate like Mitch McConnell would have done in his same circumstances. Until the Qatari bribe plane. It seems the folks at AIPAC, the American-Israel Public Affairs Committee, the lobbying group for Israel, is not too happy about their enemies in Qatar bribing their ally in Donald Trump. So, one phone call from AIPAC, from the Israeli PAC, and what do you know, Chuck Schumer suddenly now wants to put holds on all judicial nominees. Yeah, it wasn't Abrego Garcia, it wasn't our rights, you know, the chance that we might be renditioned to a El Salvadorian death camp. It's not Robert Kennedy destroying our vaccinations. It's not Doge destroying our scientific capabilities and causing a massive brain drain. None of that got Chuck Schumer to move. But boy, one phone call from Israel, one phone call from AIPAC, and Chuck's riding again, shutting down the Senate. Well, I guess I'm glad something got Chuck to move. Another thing that I read online as I go through this, people decrying Donald Trump and whatever is the latest thing that he's done. And there's a point that they'll say, well, you know, one day he'll be gone. Is today the day? I wake up every day looking at the obituaries. Is today the day? Someday he'll be gone and we'll all dance in the streets. Because no matter what, Donald Trump cannot defeat the actuarial tables. Donald Trump cannot defeat the Grim Reaper. And you know, folks, every time I hear something like that, I just remind myself that that fat, old, war criminal bastard Henry Kissinger lived to be 100 years old. Keep that in mind when you think about 78-year-old Donald Trump. And as far as renditions go, too, there were some hearings that went on in the Congress this week where they discussed, they had Kristi Noem, the canicide Kristi, cosplay Barbie from DHS there. And they were grilling her about the concentration camp in El Salvador and everything that's going on these days with ICE agents who are abducting people in the streets, wearing balaclava masks, gaiters around their face, not displaying badges, not displaying official uniforms. And the congressperson that was grilling Kristi Noem points out that there are fake ICE abductions going on now. There are dudes who are going on Etsy, getting themselves a $20 jacket that says ICE on it, and using that to go around and harass Hispanic people and harass Muslim people. And the congressperson brought this to Kristi Noem's attention. Do you realize this is possible, that this is happening, that you, since you don't have any protocols, since you're doing this with masks and without identification, that people are faking being ICE to be able to terrorize immigrant communities? And that's when Kristi Noem said, well, of course, we know exactly what we're doing. Okay, no, I made that last part up. She did not say that, but you know she's thinking it. Oh, and the other thing that happened. Oh, we got a pick, I forgot her name, for the Surgeon General of the United States, who is not a doctor. No medical expertise whatsoever. A Surgeon General who is not a doctor. Makes a ton of sense, doesn't it? Anyway, they're making a lot of fun of her. Because she's a wellness influencer, you know, one of those crystal woo-woo people. But I got to call them out on one thing that they've been making fun of her about, and that is her advocacy for psilocybin mushrooms. She discusses how psilocybin mushrooms helped her through depression, helped her find a new mate, that they were a great psychological help to her. And of course, the Beltway punditry, she's into mushrooms, magic mushrooms. There's plenty of reasons to disqualify this woman for Surgeon General. Not having a doctorate degree is probably the greatest of them. But her advocacy for entheogenic substances is not one of them. We could do a lot by having a Surgeon General who recognized the power of cannabis and psilocybin and MDMA and ibogaine and many other substances that have been criminalized in this war on those people with certain drugs that Joe Biden was the architect of. Lots of things that we are denying, lots of remedies and cures and treatments available out there for people. Just the treatments with psilocybin and alcoholism alone. It's just incredible. Having grown up with an alcoholic father, I can tell you that we would have looked for any cure for that. And how it's helping people with PTSD and severe traumas. So discount this woo-woo person all you like, but don't discount her just because she advocates for magic mushrooms. And one final thing on the federal level to get to. There's word out now, there's a bill that's out now in the House that would make all porn, all pornography, a federal crime in the United States. And I'm just here to say, I told you so. Folks, this was in Project 2025. They discussed Project 2025. In Project 2025, porn being like drugs. Porn being like a substance. Let me give you some quotes here. This is from my, what was then, Threads account. I'm not on Threads anymore. Back in 4 months ago, I said, a functional opposition party would have informed voters that Project 2025 claims that pornography has no First Amendment protections relating to free speech and refers to it as addictive as any illicit drug and as psychologically destructive as any crime. That's what Project 2025 said about pornography. And as I said 4 months ago, the octogenarian Democratic leadership can't see porn as popular adult entertainment that makes up as much as a third of all internet traffic. And porn is the canary in the coal mine of free speech. And there's no way they can be seen defending it. They see it as icky. Ooh, you can't defend porn. It's icky. You know, like trans kids or drug users or adults in poverty. Other things Democrats won't talk about. But folks, porn is the canary in the coal mine. As Larry Flint, the publisher of Hustler, put it in his landmark First Amendment Supreme Court case, you defend porn because, quote, if the First Amendment will protect a scumbag like me, it will protect all of you, end quote. Now, some of you out there might not be fans of porn. You might think porn is bad, it's bad for women, it's abusive, whatever. And we can have that discussion. However, I warn you that part of the reason for banning porn has to do with a bigger step toward criminalizing obscenity and criminalizing sodomy and fornication. Criminalizing porn is the first step toward recriminalizing what they call deviant sexuality, aka anything other than man-woman missionary style. So, you defend porn, even if you don't like it, because defending porn is what defends sexual minorities, sex workers, and other oppressed people. I'm furious about this story coming out of Georgia, where a pregnant woman who is brain dead has been hooked up to life support because she went brain dead at 9 weeks pregnant. And the state of Georgia, like the state of Idaho, has a 6-week abortion ban, with exceptions only for a reported rape or reported incest or threat to the health of the mother. And since the pregnancy is not threatening the mother's health in any way, her condition is stable, brain dead, but stable, they are forcing this woman to stay on the ventilators, on life support, to be a human incubator for her fetus, against her family's wishes. And there's so many layers to this story to get to. First of all, let's just put it out there. She's a black woman, okay? And why that is relevant is because this woman, 30-year-old Adriana Smith, last February, she was experiencing severe headaches, and she was 9 weeks pregnant. Severe headaches, 9 weeks pregnant. She goes into the doctor, goes into the hospital, and as often happens with black women and women in general, the doctor feels her concerns are overblown. Oh, you just have some headaches. Oh, it's no big deal. Here, take 2 aspirin and call me in the morning. She was released and given medications, according to the NBC report. The hospital did not run any tests. The hospital did not run any scans on this woman with severe headaches, 9 weeks pregnant. One day later, the very next day, her boyfriend finds her gasping for air and gargling. Dying right in front of her, right in front of him. So he rushes her to the hospital, and she's been declared brain dead. She had a CT scan done, finally, and the CT scan showed multiple blood clots in this woman's brain, ignored by the hospital when she complained about her severe headaches. She's been breathing through machines for more than 90 days. Her mother says, quote, "It's torture for me. I see my daughter breathing, but she's not there," end quote. The hospital plans to keep this woman on the ventilators, on life support, until 32 weeks of pregnancy, when they feel the boy would be able to survive the birth by C-section. So, this infuriates me, because the family has not been given a say in this matter, and they haven't even said whether or not they would have agreed with the whole idea of keeping her body alive to incubate the fetus. They're upset they haven't even been given a choice. She says, quote, "It should have been left up to the family. I'm not saying that we would have chosen to terminate her pregnancy, but what I'm saying is we should have had a choice." Yeah, you should have a choice, because in America, a pregnant woman, a brain-dead pregnant woman, has less right over her body than a corpse. Let me explain how this works. If I went out and got in a car wreck and was killed instantly, but my organs were salvageable, my kidneys are still good, my lungs are still good, my heart's good, my spleen, my liver, all that stuff's good, right? If I haven't signed the organ donor card, you cannot take my liver. You cannot take my lungs, my heart, my spleen, any of that other stuff. Even though I'm dead, you cannot take those body parts from me. Even if there is someone at the hospital whose life would be saved imminently from my heart or lungs or spleen or liver or whatever, or eyes or whatever. Even if there is someone right there, 5 people, one could get my heart, one could get a lung, one could get a kidney, one could get a... If there are 5 people whose lives could be saved from my organs and I'm already dead, if I haven't signed that paper, you can't take my organs. So I have complete authority over the dispensation of my body after my death. But this woman, Adriana Smith, does not have control over her uterus. One organ. Because there's an organ in her body that could save the life of a potential human, not even an existing human who needs like a liver transplant or a lung transplant, someone who's an actual living, breathing human being with a social security number, that person would die waiting for my liver if I haven't signed a paper. But a 9-week-old fetus can lay claim to a brain-dead woman's uterus. Make that make sense to me. One of the ways the right really excels in politics, more so than every other reason they excel compared to Democrats, is in their attention to detail, especially when it comes to local races. And today I want to talk about local school board races. This is where all of your book bans and anti-trans sports things start to percolate in the magosphere, is at the local school board level. And these local school board elections are oftentimes held at odd times of the year and odd years, and you may not know one is coming your way. Like me, I had no idea that tomorrow is a school board election here in Josephine County, Oregon. Now, I live in the undisclosed mountain hideaway here in Josephine County, and our local school board is called the Three Rivers School Board. So, I happened to be doing my regular shopping, and I saw the local newspaper, the Daily Courier, which had a story up about a book ban. It has to do with this book called Tricks. Now, I'll be honest, I've not read the book. But it's a young adult book, and apparently deals with some themes of a sexual nature. And as far as teenagers go, there's all sorts of things that I think that adults freak out a little too much about kids knowing. Like, I think teenagers know far more than we give them credit for, and we try to shield their innocent little minds that haven't been innocent since about age 10. So I think it's a much do about nothing, but I will always offer my disclaimer that I have no children. So I don't know what the hell I'm talking about, but anytime I see someone talking about banning books in high school and middle school libraries, that's an obvious red flag for me. So the story goes on to talk about this book, Tricks, that is going to be reviewed again by the Three Rivers School Board because of its controversy. And in the story, let me just read the story from the Daily Courier, quote, following a process that has been in place for years, all 9 books have been reviewed by school-based committees, which recommended all 9 titles be retained, including this one, Tricks. According to the district, the review committees included parents, the district said. The person who challenged the book, a retiree named Rick Nelson, who is currently a candidate for a seat on the school board, was not satisfied with the process and has appealed the decision to retain Tricks to the school board, the district said. All right, so you got a parent-led council that already reviewed Tricks and 8 other books and said, hey, these are fine for teenagers, no big deal. This guy is not good enough for him. So he decides he's going to appeal this thing, this little busybody named Rick Nelson, who's running for school board. And I thought to myself, oh, good. Now I know who to vote against for school board. So I get home, and here in Oregon, we're all vote by mail. So you get your ballot in the mail. So I get home, and I go to the my little post office box, and sure enough, there's a ballot for me and for my lady love, our mail-in little bubble sheet ballots. And I took out the ballot, and it's one of these special elections, right? We're in the middle of May in an off year. And so 3 of the 5 positions are up for voting, and all 3 positions have opposition. The rest of the positions listed on the ballot for, you know, water commissioner and, you know, fire board manager and all that, everybody else is running unopposed. And my rule is, if you're running unopposed, I don't vote for you. Like, you're winning anyway. You don't need my help. So I just leave those blank. But the 3 positions for school board, I got to know who to vote for. And already I got Rick Nelson on my list as the first guy to vote against. Now, as I've been driving around town, I've noticed Rick Nelson signs. And I've noticed other signs that have the same basic template or format. So I figure those must be all the Republican-backed people or the MAGA-backed people. They're all backed by some same group because they all have the same kind of sign. So they must be trying to put in a whole raft of these MAGA people to get into the school board. So I got to know who are the other two to vote against. Well, that's where Parents' Rights in Education comes in. There's a website out there, and this is the MAGA folks that are trying their best to install white Christian nationalist theocracy in this country. This is their little website for taking over school boards. They, of course, dress it up in the language of freedom and parents' rights. Okay, so I go to parentsrightsineducation.com, and this is where all the Ricks and Karens gather to lament that Marxist doctrine, critical race theory, and gender identity ideology in schools produce anti-American, anti-white, and anti-capitalist sentiment among students. Yeah, you really should read their about page. It's amazing. Yeah, this is all the MAGA folks. This is the Karens out there who want to ban books, want to ban Catcher in the Rye, that kind of stuff. So I looked up on parentsrightsineducation.com for the Oregon candidates, and sure enough, the other two school board candidates named Mariah Rossi and Nigel Von Hruska are both on that site. Mariah got a 100 out of 100, and Rick Nelson got a 100 out of 100, and this Nigel fella got a 96 out of 100. So there you go. Those are my three people to vote against. So my vote and Lady Love's vote for Cameron Camp, Bill Urkel, and Karen Godfrey are in the mail today. There's two more votes for each of the anti-MAGA candidates on the school board. I encourage you all to take a look at your school board elections and go to parentsrightsineducation.com to learn who to vote against. A couple of stories here from the West Coast with respect to our continuing affordable housing crisis in this nation. Headline out of California says that Governor Gavin Newsom is calling for a ban on homeless encampments. And of course, this homeless encampments ban is made possible thanks to a Supreme Court decision that came right here out of Josephine County. The Grants Pass decision, the city of Grants Pass, which is the closest city and the largest city in Josephine County, sued and made it all the way to the United States Supreme Court to discuss the law that had previously said you can't lock people up who are homeless if they got nowhere else to go. It's cruel and unusual punishment under the Eighth Amendment. And the Supreme Court decided, nah, it ain't so cruel. You can go ahead and throw them in jail if they got nowhere else to go. So that latest decision has rocked Grants Pass and the West Coast. And now Gavin Newsom appears ready to take advantage of it by calling on cities to ban homeless encampments. Now, I do have one issue with homeless encampments that I'll get to, and it has to do with my advocacy for disability rights. In my time working in medical marijuana, I met a lot of disabled people, a lot of folks using chairs and walkers and canes. In fact, the name of my studio, Rolla J Studio, comes from my buddy Rolla J, Jay Rivera, who's a wheelchair activist in California, been fighting for medical marijuana rights for a long time. And so we named the studio after him, Rolla J. He actually donated the first audio board I ever used for podcasting. So thank you, Jay. Appreciate that. But anyway, my knowledge of this issue and the accessibility problems that handicapped people face in their wheelchairs should not be ignored. And many times, especially in large cities like Los Angeles, these homeless encampments end up setting up on the sidewalks. And there's no way for anyone, it's hard to even walk past them, much less roll a wheelchair past them. Now, that's not me saying we should lock people up. What I am saying is we got to come up with a solution to this, and the solution cannot be people sleeping in the streets, people sleeping in tents in our parks. That can't be the solution. People deserve to be able to use their parks and use their sidewalks as well. But the solution is also not locking people up who have no money, who have nowhere else to go, who have been deemed irrelevant and useless to capitalism. Anytime we get into these discussions of homelessness, my solution is pretty radical. My solution to homelessness is give them homes. Yeah, it's not more complicated than that. Give them homes. No strings attached. No rules attached. None of you have to be sober. You can't have any dogs. None of that shit. Just give them a home. Give them a place to live. Every place that has tried this as a pilot project has found success and has found that the cost of getting someone a one-bedroom apartment is cheaper than all the social services costs of the homeless camp sweeps and the cleanups and the emergency room costs and the policing costs and the cleanup costs. It's just cheaper to put them in a home. This should be a right of every American to be guaranteed a safe, clean, warm place to sleep. Now, I don't know exactly how we go about doing that. I often think about Japan and how they have those little closet-sized bins that people sleep in, little nap bins that you can rent by the night. I don't know what the solution is. Building more housing projects? I know there's been problems with housing projects in the past, but the solution can't be people sleeping in the street, and it can't be locking them up. We've got to come up with something better. Now, another aspect of this homelessness crisis affects the state of Oregon and California to an extent in another way, and that is through bottle redemptions. Now, I don't know how it works in California, but here in the state of Oregon, the first state to pass what was called the bottle bill, and it has had amazing success. The bottle bill goes like this. Basically, when you go to the store and you buy a six-pack of pop, you pay 10 cents deposit on every can in that six-pack. So a six-pack ends up costing you 60 cents more, right? 10 cents a can. Then you can collect the cans, and you can take them to a redemption center. Now, there's two ways the redemption centers work. One way is you take the cans and feed them one at a time into a machine that rolls the can and reads its barcode to make sure that it is a can for which a deposit has been paid, right? So, like, you can't go to Idaho where there's no deposits and pick up a whole bunch of cans in Idaho and bring them to Oregon and make money off them, right? Because those barcodes will come up and have being purchased, you know, in different states and so on. So they read the barcodes, which means when you're collecting your cans, you can't crush them. All your cans have to be in, you know, their regular state. So people end up with these bags just chock full of empty cans, you know, and of course the cans stink from stale beer and stale soda, and the machines get all stinky and sticky, and the rooms that they're in get, the floors are stinky and sticky, and it's just awful. That's one way of doing it. And the other way is you can have a subscription. You get like a card, and you can buy these green plastic bags, like garbage bags, and then you buy these set of little barcode stickers that go to your account. So you can collect all the cans in the green bag, then take the green bag with the sticker on it into the center, and they process it for you and just put the money on your account. That's the way a lot of people in the suburbs and stuff do it. Well, this bottle redemption system acts as a de facto income source for people who are unhoused. Now, the positive side of this is you are hard-pressed to ever find cans and bottles amongst litter. In fact, you'll see people on the streets rummaging through the garbage cans trying to find those cans. And some of the smarter locations have made these new garbage cans that they that's a regular garbage can, but then the container that it's housed in has these little trays on the side for holding cans and bottles. So instead of throwing your can or bottle in the trash, you just put it on this little thing on the side, and then the next, you know, person that wants to collect it can just pick it up with it rather than having to go through the garbage, which that's a smart move. I like that. So yeah, it's great as far as recycling goes. In fact, it's something like north of 80 or 85% of all beverage containers in the state of Oregon end up being recycled. So from an environmental standpoint, it's had a very positive effect. Now let me talk about the negative effects, because that's where this story comes in the state of Oregon, where they're talking about making changes to the bottle bill, because by the law, any place that sells these bottles, you know, beverage containers, must also redeem them. And they must redeem them whenever they are open. So, if you're talking about a grocery store like a Safeway or an Albertsons or something like that, Walmart, whatever, they're open till 10 or whatever, and they're large and they got a lot of employees and they got a special section for doing the bottle returns and all that, not that big of a hassle. But if you're 7-Eleven and you're open 24 hours a day and you got one clerk working the store and you got these unhoused people coming in at 1 or 2 in the morning amongst the drunk crowds demanding to have their bottles and cans recycled while they're still dealing with all the crowds, well, it can be a real pain, a real hassle. And those redemption centers that I talked about, whenever one of those springs up somewhere, it ends up being a magnet for all of the street people to hang out, collect, trade, sell legal and illegal things. So neighbors start to raise a stink about this. So there's a story on ABC News talking about some changes that are coming forth in the legislature to maybe set hours for redemption outside of the regular store hours and maybe come up with some other limitations on how the bottle bill will work. But I want to talk about one of the unintended consequences of the bottle bill, and that is the waste, fraud, and abuse that it creates. So I lived in Portland for 15 years. One day in Portland, I'm driving around, and I see this guy on the corner, and he's near the Safeway store, and he's outside on the corner, on the sidewalk. He's got a Safeway, one of those metal Safeway shopping carts. And in the cart are three cases, 40 packs, right? Three 40 packs of bottled water. And what this guy has done is he's taken the plastic off the top of the bottle, of the whole 40 pack, right? And then unscrewed the cap on all 40 bottles and just tossed the caps on the ground, just littered. And then takes the whole 40 pack and turns it over upside down in the shopping cart so all the water is draining out onto the sidewalk there. And he does that again with two more of these containers. So he has emptied out 120 bottles of water, littering 120 little plastic caps all over the street and making that entire sidewalk wet. And why? Because as it was explained to me, this guy can take his SNAP benefits, his food stamp benefits, and go in and buy a $5 case of 40-pack water, 40-pack of water for $5. Now, the 40-pack also costs an extra $4 in deposit, and in Oregon, SNAP pays for those deposit fees. So, for $9, $5 for the water and $4 for the deposit, $9, he gets himself one 40-pack. Do that two more times, he spent $27 in food stamps on three packs of water. Then, once he drains all the water out, now he has 120 empty bottles that he can take to the recycling center to get $12 cash so he can afford a pack of cigarettes that SNAP won't buy. So there is an example of how the well-meaning bottle bill creates the unintended consequence of wasting 27, or abusing, I should say, fraudulently using and abusing $27 worth of food stamp benefits to waste 120 bottles of water and 120 bottles of plastic that didn't need to be manufactured. So this guy can afford $12 to get a pack of smokes. And yes, folks, in Oregon, a pack of smoke costs up to $12. We have a huge tax on cigarettes. So again, unintended consequences of trying to do some feel-good liberalism. My solution, radical as it is, in addition to giving them houses, give them some universal basic income. Don't make this person have to try to convert $27 of food stamps into a $12 pack of smokes. Just give the guy some money for smokes. But then again, I'm a radical. All right, folks, that sound means it's time for our regular Boycott Idaho segment, the segment where I remind you all the reasons you should avoid the handmade state. Now with 68 listed reasons to avoid Idaho. You can check them out at radicalrust.com/Idaho and help me boycott Idaho by avoiding the potato. No red state is more singularly associated with one product than Idaho and the potato. So cut back on your potato consumption, swap out them fries for a salad. It'll do your body some good, and it'll show these repressive red states that we in the blue states and throughout the nation will no longer economically support the states that regularly abuse the rights of fellow American citizens. Boycott Idaho, avoid the handmade state. And I've got two reasons for you today, number 67 and number 68 in the news. First of all, the Trump maladministration in January issued an executive order that suspended the U.S. refugee admissions program. No longer would America pay heed to the words inscribed on the Statue of Liberty, "Bring me your tired, your poor, your huddled masses yearning to be free." No longer would America be a refuge to someone who is, quote, "located outside of the United States, is of special humanitarian concern to the United States, demonstrates that they were persecuted or fear persecution due to race, religion, nationality, political opinion, or membership in a particular social group, is not firmly resettled in another country, and is admissible to the United States." No longer are we going to care for all those poor, oppressed people throughout the world. Unless they're white. Yeah, if they're white, we're going to roll out the red carpet and fast-track their admission to the United States. That's what happened on Monday when 9 South Africans resettled in Idaho, brought through an expedited program to repatriate Afrikaners, the descendants of the same racial apartheid system in which Elon Musk was raised and Donald Trump seeks to recreate. Because what better place for white people claiming reverse racial prosecution than a state with a history of harboring neo-Nazis and a state where there's only one black person per 100 people, mostly located in only 4 metro areas statewide. Idaho, the perfect place for Afrikaner, quote, refugees. Yeah, they're trying to play this game that somehow the South African government is stealing the farmland from the white South Africaners, etc., etc. Oh, woe is me. No other country in the world believes this, but Donald Trump, with, I'm sure, Elon Musk in his ear, has bought it hook, line, and sinker. So welcome to Idaho, the handmade state. And speaking of coming to Idaho, I sure hope when those South Africaners came to the state that they got their kids vaccinated, because the other reason to boycott the handmade state this week is the learning that 3 in 10 kindergartners are not vaccinated in the state of Idaho. 30% lacking full vaccination. Now, Idaho's always been near the bottom of the list for childhood vaccination rates. In fact, that generated national news coverage a couple years ago. But thanks to the Health Freedom to Infect Others law that was just passed, which, by the way, was reason number 49 to boycott Idaho, and the state's refusal to vaccinate immigrants, that was reason number 55, the handmade state has fallen to the bottom of the nation when it comes to the rate of kindergarten children getting all their recommended vaccinations for school. That would be measles, mumps, and rubella, the MMR vaccine, diphtheria, tetanus and pertussis, the DTaP vaccine, polio, and chickenpox. That's right, at the bottom for all of those childhood vaccines. And according to this report, 70% of kindergartners in Idaho have not received all 4 vaccinations. That was a number that was 76% last year and was 81% 2 years ago when it made national news. It was so shocking when they were at 81%. Now they're down to 70. And experts in the field, I mean, at least before Robert Fuckwit Kennedy was in charge of them, experts recommend a vaccination rate of 95% to achieve the so-called herd immunity that protects the children who, for whatever reason, can't be vaccinated. Idaho allows parents to seek vaccine exemptions for their children for health reasons, for religious beliefs, or just because the parents think vaccines are icky. So, because of this, about 14% of Idaho kids, about half of the unvaccinated kids, have these vaccination exemptions for all vaccines. And if you don't have a vaccination record in the state of Idaho, you can still go to school. Yeah, the law there does not allow the schools to refuse any kid if they're not vaccinated. So, move to Idaho, Afrikaners, and send your kids to public school, and 3 out of 10 of those kids aren't going to have all their vaccines. According to Sean Teagues, who is the superintendent of the Moscow, Idaho School District, and if I'm not mistaken, I think I went to high school with him. I could be a different Sean Teagues. We do have official vaccine exemption forms, but Idaho law requires that an exemption, it could be written on the back of a receipt or a half-torn piece of paper or something. Yep, that's all you need. A little doctor's note, and you can send your kid to school ready to infect all the rest of the kids. There you have it. Reason number 68 to boycott Idaho. Avoid the handmade state. Today in the Radical Rant, I want to talk about a couple of subjects that I've been thinking about lately. Anti-Semitism and transphobia. So both are, you know, terrible, terrible examples of hate and prejudice, judging a group according to stereotypes and treating them badly because of it, abrogating their civil rights, threatening them, causing terror to their community. There's a lot of similarities that are going on. Both of these are a lot in the news lately. So I want to discuss a little bit about this, and it's because while they're similar, there's one major difference in this. So when it comes to anti-Semitism, it's wrong to discriminate against Jewish people. It's wrong to advocate various tropes and stereotypes about Jewish people being, you know, money grubbing or, you know, they killed Jesus. There's a lot of these different stereotypes that are out there. Shocking and they're wrong and they're terrible. And all forms of anti-Semitism should be condemned. We shouldn't hate Jewish people for being Jewish, for worshiping the way they choose to worship, for their ethnicity. It's wrong to be prejudiced and discriminate against the people. However, when it comes to fighting anti-Semitism, nobody ever requires me to believe the Jews are God's chosen people. When I'm fighting anti-Semitism, nobody requires me to believe that Moses actually received the Ten Commandments on stone tablets from a burning bush and had the power to part the Red Sea with his staff. I'm not required to believe in Judaism to defend Jews. I'm not required to believe in Judaism to fight against anti-Semitism. All I'm required to believe is that Jewish people have the right to their religion. Jewish people are who they are by their ethnic identity in many cases. An immutable fact of life. Some of them are Jewish people because they chose Judaism. They converted to Judaism. Regardless of the reason they became Jews, what they believe in their Judaism, it is wrong to discriminate against them. It is wrong to terrorize them. But nobody requires me to believe that Jews are God's chosen people. Do you see where I'm going with this? Because when it comes to fighting transphobia, we should not treat transgender people differently for who they are internally, who they are ethnically, if you want to put it that way. Or if they just chose that identity. Regardless, we should not subscribe to stereotypes about transgender people, like they're going to attack women in bathrooms or something like that. We can fight against transphobia, but why is it that transphobia requires that being pro-trans requires me to believe Jews are God's chosen people? Oh, I'm sorry, no. Transphobia requires me to believe trans women are women. It seems that the trans movement is the only movement that requires out of the people that support it to believe its ideology 100%. If you come out there, as I have many times, and say you are absolutely for transgender rights, transgender people should have all the rights everyone else has, they should be able to use the bathrooms they want to use, they should be housed in the prisons that match their gender identity, they should be able to compete in the sports that match their gender identity, but their gender identity is not their sex. Their sex is male or female and has been since they were born and is genetically set and is immutable. You go and say that and people call you transphobic. Now, if I come out and say that Jews should not be discriminated against and anti-Semitism is wrong, but I'm an atheist, I don't believe in God and all that Moses stuff is mumbo jumbo, nobody calls me anti-Semitic because I don't believe Judaism. Nobody calls me anti-Semitic because I'm an atheist. But boy, you question trans women are women and you get labeled a TERF. You're a trans exclusionary radical feminist. You're a TERF. And they call for all sorts of terrible things to happen to you. It's not enough to be able to support their rights in every way. They seem to be demanding that you believe as they believe as well. And that's where, again, I've said this many times, I think the transgender issue goes off the rails is in trying to force everyone who supports them to believe like them. One example, the whole pronouns thing. So everybody makes jokes about this pronouns thing, and you know the people who are against it, make the "I identify as a Prius" joke. You know, the one joke they have. But here's where the pronouns thing went off the rails. If you're a transgender person, I can understand why you would want to put out your pronouns. Maybe you're not passing so well, and people are mistaking you. If you're a trans woman, maybe they are mistaking you for a man too often, calling you sir or he, and it really bothers you. And so in your email signature or other places, you put your pronouns, she/her, or they, them, if you're non-binary. And that's great for you. And I think everybody's cool with that. Okay. Well, thank you, Sarah, for telling me that your pronouns are she, her. Thank you. Where it went off the rails is when HR departments started telling everyone else they have to put their pronouns in their bio. Now, people on the trans side don't see the big deal here. Well, what's the big deal? It's just polite. This way, oh, the trans person doesn't have to be the only person saying they are she, her, or they, them, or he, him, and thereby outing themselves and exposing themselves compared to everyone else as being a trans person. Well, why not? If there's nothing wrong with being a trans person, what big deal would it be if you were the only person putting she, her in your email signature? Because what it does to cisgender people is to some of them, I won't say all of us feel this way. I don't even feel this way. But I know some people do. For most cisgender people, their gender presentation matches their sex. Obviously, that's what cisgender means, right? So for them, for there to be even a question that their gender wouldn't match their sex, is an indictment of their ability to pass or to present as male or female. You get my drift here? Like, here's Tommy, Mr. Buff Super Stud, works out every day, big muscles, got tattoos, rides a Harley. And then you're coming in saying, hey, Tommy, we need you to tell people whether you're a he or a her. Whether you're a he or a she. Well, from Tommy's point of view, it's like, well, what the fuck do I look like? What the fuck do you think I am? In Tommy's mind, you've just indicted, you've just questioned his presentation of his sexuality. You've just misgendered him in his mind by asking him, by even presenting the case that there might be a doubt that he's presenting as male. That's where it went off the rails. Forcing people to present their pronouns is a form of misgendering them. Now, allowing it for it to happen, asking if people want to put their pronouns there, giving them a place to put their pronouns, sure, great. But you start mandating it, and it makes people feel like they're not presenting their gender well. I hope people can understand this and take this in the spirit with which it's meant. I always offer the disclaimer, I am 100% pro-trans rights. Absolutely. Every job, locker room, bathroom, military, sports, I'm all for it. You take a seat, you plan it, you grow. But I don't have to completely 100% believe the ideology to support the people. And it goes down smooth. Hey! Well, folks, that's all the time we've got for this week. The Radical Russ Show is produced, directed, researched, written, recited, posted, and catered by me, Radical Russ Belville, and governed by Creative Commons share-alike licensing. My main theme is We Love the Herb by Herbal Nation, and the interstitial music is by me, my bass, and a drum machine. News clips and social media posts are reproduced under fair use copyright laws for commentary and analysis. And now, for our post-credits screen, just want to make a couple recommendations on cable. If you're checking out, I think Hulu has the new documentary about Sly and the Family Stone. Questlove directed this documentary. Another great Questlove documentary. He did one on the Summer of Soul as well. This one on Sly Stone is amazing, especially from a musician's point of view. He's got all of like the master tapes, and so you can hear track by track how certain songs were put together and how they evolved over time. Amazing. Highly recommended. Questlove's documentary on Sly Stone. Also, some talk out there about Weird Al Yankovic. John Mulaney made a post calling for Weird Al Yankovic to be inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. I want to heartily second that nomination. Weird Al so deserves to be in the Hall of Fame. This guy is the best parodist of all time, no bar none, and plays accurately in so many different genres. I mean, he does rap, he does polka, he does rock. It's just amazing. Some of his covers, I think, are better than the original songs, like Amish Paradise or Gump or It's All About the Pentium. So, Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, get on it. Get Weird Al into the Hall of Fame. Can you imagine the induction concert? Can you imagine, like, the people he's parodied getting up on stage and doing covers of his parodies? Like, get Madonna up there doing Like a Surgeon? That would be amazing! And, one last thing. The Handmaid's Tale Season 6 is out. I finally got caught up on Handmaid's Tale Season 6. And if you're watching it and you don't want any spoilers, turn the podcast off now. Okay, so here's the spoiler. So at the end there, when June is trying to get all the handmaids who are now her little army out of the room from Aunt Lydia, at the very end she's had that big showdown with Aunt Lydia and she's speaking to Aunt Lydia, they got that one guardian there, the one man in his full tack gear with a pistol, and he's holding everybody at bay with the pistol and not doing anything else. Like, he's not calling for backup. He's not forcing June or Lydia to shut up. He's just standing there? Really? Nah, I don't buy it. That threw the scene off for me completely. And then, once, you know, Lydia and June finish their little discussion, and then June is running out with all the handmaids, he's just like watching them go. Oh, see you later. In an authoritarian regime where this guy is the equivalent of the Gestapo and women are chattel, he's just going to sit there and listen to a bunch of women make plans to take down the country? I don't buy it. It's terrible. Take that guy out of the scene. You don't need him in the scene anyway. The whole scene still has tension with Lydia and June. You know, with the threat that Lydia might go and call the Guardians if she doesn't get through this scene well. So, I don't know. That's just my considered opinion on the matter. You can contact me by email at radicalrus@gmail.com. Call my message line at 877-RUS-420. That's 877-877-420. And reach me on social media on Blue Sky as @radicalrus.com and nowhere else. You can support this podcast financially by donating to Radical Russ on Venmo, Rad Russ on Cash App, or via PayPal on my newly redesigned website at radicalrus.com. Get this podcast on Spotify, Apple Music, my website, or wherever you get your podcasts. Thanks for listening, and until next week, take care of each other. And who wants a puppy?
You plan it.